I'm going to, I hope, finish the discussion about quantization of gauge theory and discuss some of the basic physics of non-abelian gauge theories, namely asymptotic freedom and confinement, built on all the formalism that I've been discussing the two previous lectures that show how to quantize properly non-abelian gauge theories, treating the gauge invariance and the gauge fixing procedure in a precise mathematical way that respects the underlying symmetry of the theory. So we have seen that we start, well, let us start again just from SU2 gauge theory. And we have seen that in order to quantize the theory properly, starting from the gauge field A mu A of X, we need to introduce, well, there is a term in the proper gauge fixing condition that can be modeled by Gauss, so these are the gauge field. We are going to consider, for instance, matter fields like Dirac fermions. Okay, and we have to introduce our Gauss piece, namely the Gauss that carries some index A and some anti-Gauss that carry some index A that are necessarily for gauge fixing. So they represent, in fact, the term in the functional integral that you have to introduce. And this is if we are going to introduce a gauge fixing condition. And starting from that, the total Lagrangian you have to write, the total action, if you want, will be something like integral d4x. There will be a minus 1 over g squared trace with a factor of 2 trace of f mu nu. Well, let us write it in this way, without a trace, with just our indices, f mu nu a. F mu nu A, this is a Lagrangian action, and we have the psi bar I alpha I covariant derivative minus M of psi beta with an alpha beta here, which is a Dirac indices, and this is a matrix acting in the on the fundamental representation of the matter fields. And then we have the gauge fixing condition that we can write something like if we are using the Lorentz-Feynman gauge, this is something like d mu a mu a square, so d nu a with some coefficient in front of that. I think I called it xi, but okay. And then we have this famous gauge field contribution, which is C bar A d mu of d mu CB, where this is a matrix AB. Okay? And this is the covariant derivative, so both these terms and these terms contains the gauge field. And remember, F mu nu A is d mu A nu A minus d nu A mu A plus or minus I, the commutator of A mu and nu A. Okay. And we have seen that this induces some, well, the perturbation rules are that there is a propagator for the gauge field, which will be the same propagator than for the photon in quantum electrodynamics. We have a propagator for the matter fields, the fermions, which is a Dirac propagator, the standard Dirac propagator. We have a propagator that I'm going to write like this for the ghosts. And the ghosts carry charges, but there are also there are ghosts and anti-ghosts, so there is an arrow that tells you that this is, for instance, a two-point function from between C and C bar. One has to take care of the direction of the arrow because the ghost field anti-commutes like the Dirac fields. And we have vertex interaction. And the vertex interaction are basically, well, we are going to have the standard vertex interaction for the fermion field. It will be the same than the Dirac field, just dressed with some TA, taking into account the charge of the field. And we have, but now we have new terms. We have a term that carries the interaction between the ghosts and the gauge field, because there is a covariant derivative here. And d mu, the covariant derivative, as usual, is something like d mu plus I a mu in the fundamental representation. And this is d mu plus I commutator of a mu with what you are going to compute in the adjoint representation. Okay, so here there is a coupling a mu between the ghosts. And in addition, we have coupling between the gauge field, because the gauge field carry charges, so they interact. Okay? And one important point to notice is that now this propagator basically behaves like 1/p². It's just a propagator of the photon, roughly speaking. The propagator of the Dirac field behaves like 1/p. It's 1/p². So it has dimension -1 in momenta, and this has dimension -2 in momenta. The propagator of the ghost, since the ghost contains the d mu, it behaves also like 1/p². Okay? And the three gluon vertex comes from the combination of 1 d mu and 2 a mu a nu. So it behaves like it contains a dependence in the momenta. If you want, you can write it that it has some complicated group, well, a bit complicated group theoretical structure that I wrote last time. There is a structure coming from the fact that the photon has spin, so you have a Lorentz indices combination. But the important point is that if you have a momenta here coming, it's proportional to this P. So it's a vertex that contains in the dependence in the momentum, because it tells what is the interaction between the momentum of one gauge field and the spin of the gauge field, if you want, it interacts with. Okay. Well, this is order one, because it's just an A, so it has a complicated group structure and Lorentz structure, but in terms of momenta, it's one. And here again, the interaction between the fermionic field is just a psi, a mu psi, so it's over the one. It's just the ordinary vertex of QED for the electron photon interaction. But these terms contains a C d mu a mu CB, so it also contains, something like that. It contains a term proportional to some momentum P, where P is some momentum flowing through this line. I'm just rewriting in a very sketchy way the form, the dependence in the momenta of the three propagator for gauge field, for the fermion, Dirac fermion, and for the ghosts. Okay, so now we are in a situation where we can discuss now whether and why the theory is renormalizable. So we're going to analyze ultraviolet divergences. And renormalizability of the SU2 gauge theory. And I explained to you yesterday at the end of the lecture that in fact the gauge field has potential problems because there are unphysical degrees of freedom, unphysical polarization of the gauge field, exactly as in QED. But since the gauge field are coupled to themselves, they interact, and so the mixing between, there is a potential and very dangerous mixing between the physical polarization and the unphysical polarization. You may very well have just a state that comes with the physical polarization and some unphysical states that come out. And one has to check whether all the quantum dynamics manage to cancel those contributions, so that the various amplitudes associated to some Feynman diagrams, you know, give potentially dangerous cancellation, but they cancel term, but they cancel at the end. That's the idea. That's what people have discovered. Okay, so let me show you first why there is a problem. So let me just write first the two-point irreducible. So I'm going to consider the irreducible, as usual, the irreducible functions at one loop. Okay? Because we have seen in the 5-4 theory that it is this quantity that contains the ultraviolet divergence, and if we control them, we control all the theory. We can reconstruct all the theory, all the amplitudes, all the green function, all the S-matrix element out of this. Okay. So let me first write for the two gluon function, so two-gauge field. So first we have the inverse of the propagator. Let me write it like that, but this is the inverse of the propagator. And then we have some diagrams, and here are the diagrams. I think I wrote them. Okay. We have a diagram like that. Well, if you want, there is a symmetry factor here. There is a symmetry factor like this. So this is a diagram where you have a tadpole of gluons. This is a gluons. And in addition, you have a diagram where you have a gauge field or gluon. Okay. That interacts with a ghost, so there's a loop of ghosts circulating. And since the ghosts are fermions, exactly as in QED for internal loops of fermions, there is a minus sign, very important. And then, in addition, we are going to have for the theory coupled to matter, the ordinary loop of fermions, as in QED. Okay, so these are, and of course, this diagram is of order one, and all these diagrams are of order G squared. The coupling constant of the gauge field, because this is of order G. This is over the G squared, this is over the G, and this is over the G. Okay? And also one important remark that I didn't do, but that is well known, the symmetry of the gauge theory fixes the relation between the charge of the fermions, the charge of the ghosts and the charge of the gauge field. You cannot say, okay, let the gauge field as charge, well, in some units, 1, and the fermions as charge 2.5. Because all the couplings are determined by matrix element of generator of the various representation of the gauge group. Therefore, there is a very relation. So if the gauge group is, let's say, semi-simple, basically, all the coupling, namely all the charge, are fixed by the representation. So, gauge field and ghost lives in the adjoint representation. So this is the relation between the charge of ghost and the charge of the gauge field. And here I consider Dirac field that lives in the adjoint in the fundamental representation. So this gives another relation. The relation will be different if the fermions, the matter fields, were living in the adjoint representation of some higher dimensional representation. But basically, this depends on the gauge group and on the representation for matter. Okay? Good. Okay, so this is the ordinary term, and this is the irreducible function. So we have seen that basically the inverse of the propagator, once we have chosen a well-defined gauge fixing procedure, this behaves like delta AB. This behaves like, this is delta AB minus P squared H mu nu plus P mu P nu, at least in the Landau group, in the Lorentz Landau gauge, where this parameter chi is set equal to 0 here. So set equal to infinity, so that we enforce the constraint that d mu a mu equals 0. Otherwise, it's a bit more complicated. There is just a modification. But this is this object. Okay. And now, the question is, so now let us look at the potential ultraviolet divergence of these terms. So you see, this diagram it looks like the simplest loop diagram of the 5-4 theory, which contains a log of lambda divergence. But there may be a P circulating in this momenta and this momenta. You may have a P. So here, if I have P here, I have a momentum K here, and I have a momentum K plus P circulating here. I may very well have 1 over k squared, 1 over k plus p squared, but a k here and a k plus p here. That's one of the contributions. You may have some p dependence on p here, so you have many terms, but among them, you have a term that behaves like k squared over k to the 4. Okay. So this means that, in fact, there is a potential quadratic divergence at short distance. And okay, one point that is important, I am not going to discuss precisely which ultraviolet regularization I'm going to use. And that's a delicate point, because one has, in order to be sure what one is doing, one has to use a ultraviolet regularization that is compatible with gauge invariance. And many of the regularizations that one can use for ordinary quantum field theory, for instance, phi 4 will break gauge invariance. So for instance, the sharp cutoff is problematic. Okay. You can make some gauge invariant polyvillar regularizations that are a bit better behaved, replay taking higher covariant derivative terms, but they induce some problem because they induce other problem. Okay. So the two known ultraviolet regularization schemes that respect gauge invariance, as far as I know, well, there may be some other one. Well, there are some other, but basically, what you have is a lattice regularization. And this has been introduced by Wilson in 64. I'm not going to describe that that way, but there is a way to put the quantum theory. And dimensional regularization. Which consists in stating that the dimension of space-time is different from 4. So this was used by Toft and Veltman in the calculation of randomization of Gauss theory. It was dimensional regularization was not invented by them, but they were among the first to use them in clever lab. So in lattice, if you have a sharp cutoff, it means that you have some momenta less than lambda, but that's problematic. But in lattice regularization, the analog of lambda will be just 1 over A, where A is the mesh of the lattice. And in dimensional regularization, the parameter will be the, basically D minus 4. Yes?
So the problem with not being able to use the sharp cutoff is because
the k's
are not eigenvalues of the gauge invariant capacity.
Yeah, you can say that. Yes.
But then, if we did consider the eigenvalues of a gauge invariant,
if
we did consider the eigenvalues of something analogous to a gauge invariant capacity,
one can do that, and that's some kind of gauge invariant zeta function regularization. But it works at one loop, but I think it's difficult to make it working at every loop. When you are doing calculation at one loop, you can always reduce things to calculation of some determinant of some functional operator. We have seen that the one loop effective action is just the logarithm of the determinant or the trace of the log of some operator, which will be some kind of gauge invariant operator. So if you regularize that in a proper way, cutting out the eigenvalues, then you are fine. But beyond one loop, it's more complicated. Okay. So anyway, if we have a log of lambda divergence in the sharp cutoff, well, we expect to have a log of 1 over A divergence in lattice regularization. And in fact, it turns out that we have a pole in 4 minus D in dimensional regularization. So a pole, which looks like a linear divergence, in fact, correspond to a logarithmic divergence. And if you are a bit more careful, a lambda squared divergence would correspond to 1 over A squared divergence, and it would correspond to a pole in 2 minus D. So divergence that occurs already at smaller dimensions. Okay, so these are the nature of the singularities. Okay, so now I'm going to do the analysis just thinking in terms of momenta and using F if there was a sharp cutoff, but it's just a first discussion. Okay, so again, this two-point gain function depends on the momenta. So let us call it, it depends on the momenta. It carries spin indices and group indices. So now, this diagram, so we have seen that it contains a quadratic divergence. So we expect that it will have a term of the form, well, let me call it Lambda squared. So it has a lambda squared times something. And by Lorentz invariance, it will be an H mu nu, the metric tensor, and a delta AB. But then it may have other divergence. Then it will have subdominant divergence at some log lambda divergence. And there will be still, because of the symmetry of the SU2 group, it will only be a delta AB. But then you may have a term. So this is a log lambda. So it has to be proportional to some momenta. And the only momentum that is available is P, because this is a massless theory. So we can have only P mu, P nu, or P squared H mu nu. See? And then subdominant term, finite. Terms plus subdominant terms. That, okay. And well, if you do the calculation in a proper way, what you find is that there is some coefficient here. Let me call this A1. There will be a coefficient here that is A2. A prime one, let us say. Let me write this. Yes, A prime one. And another possible coefficient here, A double dot 1. The 1 is because I'm computing at one loop order. And A double prime is because. Okay. And now, if you think a little bit about that, these diagrams will contribute to this term. And this term. This diagram is just a tadpole diagram. So it just contributes to this term. There is no P squared dependence. Okay. And this diagram may also give the lambda squared divergence, because you may very well have the propagator of the ghost is 1 over P squared. So here I have a 1 over K squared, and here I have a 1 over K plus P squared. But there may be a K here and a K here. Well, there is, in fact, a K here. It must be there. OK, so this diagram has also a lambda squared divergence, a log lambda divergence with the two possible terms. OK. OK, so at one loop, the two-point function contains a term like that. So basically, this means that the two-point function, let me write it, the gamma mu nu AB of P at, it's given by this, let's call pi AB mu nu of P at tree level, plus G squared times the contribution at one loop, which is of this form. You see. So this means, of course, that there is a renormalization of the coefficient. But this term is very bad, because this pair corresponds to introduce a mass, give a mass to the gauge field. So it means that there is a potential radiative correction mass, a mass given to the gauge field by the radiative corrections. Because this term will correspond to adding to the action a term lambda squared d mu, I'm sorry, lambda squared a mu in the action, which is not gauge invariant. Okay? And when you do the calculation, I'm not going to do the calculations, they are a bit lengthy, but the important is the result. You discover that if you take into account just these two diagrams, the contribution is on zero. But if you take into account the contribution of the ghost loops, with the minus signs, it cancels. So that's one of the reasons why people for several years in the, many years in the 60s, you know, were not confident in gauge theories because they had not understood how to quantize them properly. And then they were saying, okay, gauge theories, non-Abelian gauge theory, are non-renormalizable because we compute the radiative correction, and there is a mass that breaks the gauge invariance. But once you have taken a proper scheme to quantize the theory, taking into account the gauge fixing, this term disappears. Okay, so that's the point. And now you see also that there must be a relation between this term and these terms in order to have the proper form for the two-point function. Otherwise, again, it's not gauge invariant. If this term disappears, gauge field stays massless. But if this term, if there is a different term between this term and these terms, the longitudinal modes propagates, and you have still unphysical state. So to have no unphysical state, unphysical states requires two things. First, that A1 equals zero. And second, that A prime one plus A double prime one equals zero. So that this is minus this, and you get just and it turns out that's what's going on if you use a proper regularization. Okay, so this is a consequence of gauge invariance. Okay. And so this means that, in fact, the logarithmic ultraviolet divergence can be absorbed just in the redefinition in rescaling of the field, because it's just a multiplication of this three-level potential by some terms, which is 1 plus g squared times lambda. So this will imply that, in fact, for the two-point function, there is a what's called a renormalization of the gauge field A. I'm good. So you have to just change the normalization of your operator that is associated to gauge field. OK. So it's just that you are not working the right unit of. OK. So now, let's go back to the second. The tree gauge field. We have seen that this is the contribution at tree level. It's some vertex, so let us call it gamma mu nu a b c. So it depends. So I have here a vertex. With a mu A, mu B, and rho C, group and Lorentz indices and spin indices. And this depends on the momenta K1, K2, and K3 that goes into the vertex. So it's a function of K1, K2, and K3. course, we must have k1 plus k2 plus k3 equals zero, conservation of the momenta, because the theory is translation invariant. And we have seen that this gives us first some vertex, V, let us say, A, B, C, mu, nu, rho of the case. This is just a tree-level vertex. And then, at one loop, we may have several diagrams. So I'm just, I'm not just drawing all the diagrams because you may have permutation of the external legs and the indices, but that's the topology. So you have diagrams like that, a diagram like this one. Okay. And you have many different diagrams depending where is the four vertex and the three vertex are situated. So you have several of them. And then you have a diagram where you have a loop, an internal loop of ghosts. Again, with a minus sign. Oh, and then, well, I have not discussed the effect of the fermions, but the Dirac field will be, the loop of the Dirac field will be treated exactly like in QED, except for the group factor. So it contributes just by a log. But we know in the Dirac field that it's a log with a p minus p squared plus p mu nu. So it respects gauge invariance. Okay, so let's forget about okay, and you see that this diagram is over the G. So there is a G factor. Because there is one vertex, and this, all these diagrams are over the G cube. Okay, because there are three vertex, or one, three, and one vertex. Okay, good. So now, look at what's the structure of this term? These diagrams, it has a 1 over k squared, 1 over k squared, 1 over k squared. But there may be a k, and a k going on. So there is a potential lambda divergence. Here, this is the same. There is a potential lambda divergence. Okay. However, this divergence has to be proportional to. That's what I thought, but perhaps I was wrong. My statement was that this divergence. Okay. So there is a G, and then there is a term of G cube. And there is a potential lambda divergence. But this divergence turns out to be zero. There is a cancellation between the lambda here. Oh, no, in fact, it is zero simply because of parity invariance. If you change the momentum k here, you change the sign. So because of parity, I think, but in fact, zero. Okay, that's for some symmetry. So there remains log lambda. A log lambda divergence. Count that there may be a log lambda here, a log lambda in this graph and the log lambda in this graph. Yes?
Sorry, you may have already said this, but why don't we have a diagram just like the one with the ghost field, but with the fermions?
I just didn't draw it.
Isn't it that?
Yeah. I neglect, because this diagram is a diagram that appears already in QED, and we treat it as in QED, but if you prefer, I can write it. But this diagram is diagram that is treated by QED, so it has the same structure. It will have a log lambda, it will contribute. Oh no, because in QED there is no such, yes, there is such a diagram in QED. But it will not give rise to a divergence, because there is no, for some parity reason, there is no divergence associated to a three photon vertex in QED, as far as I know. Okay. So the problematic diagram are these ones. Okay. And, well, you do the calculation and you found that there is a divergence, a log lambda. It will have a complicated dependence in the group indices, not very complicated, but complicated dependence in the group indices and the Lorentz spin indices. Basically, FABC will be epsilon ABC, but there is some combination of the K and the H. And it turns out that it's proportional to the same V, V mu nu alpha beta gamma, plus some finite term with some coefficient B1, let us say, for this diagram. This diagram will contribute only to a finite term because of gauge invariance. If you don't take into account the ghost loop, again, it doesn't have the same form than this one. So there is a potential divergence, but well, we expect that it will correspond to a renormalization of the coupling constant. As in phi to the 4. But you see that here you need gauge invariance to enforce the fact that the divergence has the same form than the vertex. Okay, then same picture for the 4-point function where we have a G squared term, and then we have then we can have many different diagrams. We can have a diagram like this, plus a diagram of this form, plus a diagram of this form. Minus diagram with an internal loop of ghosts. And all these diagrams, where these are gluons, my drawing starts to be messy. These are gauge field, are of order G to the 4. Again, these diagrams may contain a 1 over k, 1 over k, 1 over k, 1 over k integrated over k to the 4. So it may contain a log of lambda. These diagrams may contain a log of lambda. There is no linear divergence. This also, and this diagram also. So all of these diagrams contain log of lambda divergence. So this first diagram was had a definite form. So it was something like G squared V mu nu rho sigma. Well, here I put the index up and here I put them down. So my notation are not very, very consistent, but it's not important. So this diagram depends on the group and spin indices carried by the legs, the gauge plume. And in order to have a theory with respect to gauge invariance, what you have to check is that the total dependence in the spin and group indices turns out to be the same V mu nu rho sigma A B C, which in that case is independent on the momenta. That's different from here. With some coefficient, let's call it this. Here I had a B, so this will be a C. 1 plus finite pair. Again, if you forget the loop, the ghost internal loop, you are in trouble. Okay? Well, is that all what we need to normalize the theory? Well, in principle, yes, but no, because forget that. So this was a loop. We also have a potential diagram that is the ghost propagator that contains a contribution, a correction, which is of the same form than so that's the same diagram that for the self-energy of the electron, that's sometimes the self-energy of the ghost. And again, there is a potential, remember, this is 1 over k squared. This is 1 over k squared, but there is a k. So it contains a potential lambda divergences that it disappear, exactly like in quantum electrodynamics, where you have a potential linear divergence in the radiative correction to the mass of the electron, but it disappears. In fact, it disappears because of some symmetry, which is the axial symmetry associated. So there is a good reason. And there is a log. So remember, the potential for the fermion was delta, the inverse propagator for the ghost was delta AB P squared. And then we have a correction, which is G squared. We have a log lambda, and the calculations tells you, you find that in fact the correction is of the form delta AB, as you expect, P squared, with some coefficient D1, which is a number. Okay, so that's, so if you want the wave function, what does this mean? It means that the gluon stays massless, but there is a renormalization of the wave function, of the ghost fields, or renormalization of what you call the wave function of the state of the ghost, exactly like for the A field. And finally, remember that the ghosts interact with the gauge field. So there is a factor of order G here. And the first radiative correction is something like this. So first, you have the well-known diagram of QED that renormalizes the interaction vertex. But in addition, you have another diagram, which is these diagrams. Okay? And again, this diagram depends on the momenta, because remember, it's something like carries a vertex A, a B, and a C, and a mu index. This is a gauge field. So there is a there is some U A B C mu. Sorry, let me put them all. A B C mu of P vertex, which is just some. Here it's epsilon A B C P mu, in fact, but and of course, this is a G cube. And so there is one vertex here, and here you have three vertex. So this is a G cube. And you have a G cube. You have, if you count, you have a potential logarithmic singularity here, exactly like in QED. Here also, so you have a log of lambda. And if you do the calculation, you found that this is precisely the same U A B C mu of P with some coefficient E1 plus finite term. Okay. So there is a renormalization of the coupling between the ghost and the gauge field. And that's it. In fact, you can check that the other diagrams ultraviolet finite. For instance, the five loop diagrams, or diagrams that would involve two gluons interacting with the ghost, vanishes. Good. Okay, so I just show you how it works. And now to compute those coefficients is just a matter of sitting down for 2 hours. So for me, mm-hmm. for you, you are younger, so you compute faster and you make less mistakes. But you sit down and you compute, and that's just some quite a standard algebra. And you can find all the details of the calculation in, for instance, the book by Peskin and Schroeder. So is it the end? So seems that we have, if everything works like that, we think that the theory is renormalizable. But it's not guaranteed yet that it respects gauge invariance. Because remember, we started from an action, the action that I've wrote here, if you want, the action that I've wrote at tree level, which is a function of A, C, and C bar. OK, I forget about the fermions, but at the moment. It's just an integral over d4x. And you have the terms of the form dA, dA, plus a term g times dA, A times A. I'm just writing in a very sketchy form, so no indices, no group indices, no Lorentz indices, just a very shortened way to write. This is the gauge invariant form of the propagator, the gauge invariant form of the three gauge field interaction, the gauge invariant term of the four interaction terms, and then you have the C bar minus D squared C interaction. Well, I can write it as, if you prefer, I can write it as d c bar d c interaction, and a g times d c bar c a interaction terms. So that's the general form of the action. Okay, and gauge invariance, remember, fixes those coefficients. So basically, these coefficients are one because of gauge invariance. So now, what we say is that we can renormalize the theory by replacing in the path integral this by a renormalized action that will be dependent on the field A, C bar, and C, of the form, well, the same coefficient, but with a coefficient here. For instance, here A, let us go dA dA plus B times dA AA plus C AA AA. That's a D times T C bar DC plus E times D C bar CA. Okay, this calculation tells us that if I replace the, if you want, bare action here above by a renormalized action, then when I'm computing a correlation function, you know, by such a kind of exponential of I as R, I get finite quantities in the limit lambda goes to infinity, namely the continuum limit. Lambda goes to infinity means D goes to 4, for instance. Okay, so I constructed a renormalized theory. Okay, and that's possible because from the form of the divergence, the fact that the divergence are of the same form than the original vertex, basically, I can take that, well, if I'm not mistaken, I choose that A equals 1 minus G. Well, just this very coefficient, you have only one coefficient for the two-point function. Let's say A prime. A prime 1 times log of lambda, so this is something that's compensated for the divergence. And again, as usual, we have to introduce at scale a renormalization scale mu, exactly like phi to the 4. That's exactly the same thing. In order to find the renormalized quantity we have to stay to specify at which scale I define what is the renormalized coupling constant. For instance, it's the value of the three-point function for some momenta equal mu. So this will be a renormalized coupling constant. Okay. And this defines GR, a renormalized coupling constant. And the same for the other things. B will be has to be equal to G minus G squared B1 log of lambda over mu, etc. So C will be equal to G squared minus G cube C1 log lambda over mu, etc. Okay, with renormalized coupling constant. And this action will be gauge invariant if, when I make a change of variable, this action has the same form than that with the right coefficient. Because remember, if I take an action like that, but here I take a factor 2 g squared, it's not gauge invariant anymore. So there are relations. Gauge invariance comes only if you have some relation between the coefficients, the renormalized coefficient. And basically, what you want is that you want to be able to rewrite this renormalized action as a three-level action, which is a function of some bare field, C, bare, and of course, this action depends on the bare coupling constant, D. depends on the constant. So and this action depends on G renormalized, because they are G renormalized in the coefficient. So I want to be able to rewrite this renormalized action as the original action, the bare action, with a bare coupling constant. So G bare will be a bare coupling constant. The A, B, C bar B, and C B will be the bare fields. Okay. And of course, in order to be that, in order to map this into this, you need some sets of relation between the coefficient. And if you work out a bit the algebra, you check very easily that the bare field has to be equal to the renormalized field by a coefficient A 1/2, so that this is reabsorbed into the bare field. You can take C bare to be D 1/2 C, and C bar bare equal D 1/2 C bar. But that's not enough. This has the law to write this as a D, this term, and this term as these terms. But then you need to have a relation which states that it's the same coefficient here, here, and here in terms of the bare coupling constant. So in fact, you need, in addition, that the bare coupling constant is defined both by B times A to the power minus 3/2. That's if I want to identify this coefficient with the bare coupling constant. But if I want to identify this coefficient with the square of the bare coupling constant, I will get that it has also to be C 1/2 A minus 1. And if I want to identify this coefficient with the bare coupling constant, this has also to be equal to E D minus 1 A minus 1/2. Okay? And this is possible only if there is a relation between the coefficient of the divergence. And namely, if you want to write this relation, this gives two relations. This means that C1 equals 2B1 minus 2A1. And E1 equal D1 plus B1 minus A1, well, if I'm not mistaken. So it means simply that there is a relation between the singularity. So if we didn't, and it turns out that this is true, this is satisfied. Thanks to gauge symmetry. You do the calculation and you check that this is correct. And so this guarantees that first the theory is renormalizable at one loop, and second that it is still gauge invariant. The renormalized theory still satisfies the gauge invariant. Okay. Okay. Well, I went a bit slowly, but I think that's just because it's important to see how it works. So that's a very pedestrian approach, but that's how the first calculation were done. Okay. So now, of course, here is just a check. For instance, if you compute in dimensional regularization and you check that everything works. But of course, you need a formalism that ensures you why it works and why it works at all orders. In fact, let me just mention that you have to look at the identities, which are that the function of the series must satisfy. And such problem exists already in QED. In order to show that QED is renormalizable, you have to engage invariance. You have to check that when you renormalize the theory, it satisfies some basic identities, relations that are implied by gauge invariance. And then when you renormalize that next order, you still violate. Okay, and so those identities are called the Ward Takahashi, I think, identities in QED. So there is a form that is well adapted to gauge theories. There is a slightly more general form that is called the Taylor Slavnov identities that are well adapted for Young-Mills theory. And they have been used, for instance, by Lee and Zinn-Justin, who were the first to prove that at all order, gauge theory were renormalizable. And I think this was around 74, something like that. So the first calculation, of course, was done by Toft and Toft and Veltman in 72. Okay. And then there is a very beautiful formalism. I won't have time to discuss it. That is called the BRST formalism that allows also to encode all the properties of the gauge theory into some kind of supersymmetry involving the ghosts. Because if you start from a theory which is like that, with a gauge fixing term, it's no more it's no more gauge invariant because the gauge invariant has been fixed. So you have lost local gauge invariance, but it has to be replaced by something. And the symmetry that replaces the gauge invariance of the original theory is no gauge fixing term. There is a symmetry that is called the BRST symmetry. BRST calls for Becky, Rouet, Stora, and, well, I never, Tiutlin or something like that. So there are some Russian and French and Italian team that discovered around 74, 75, I think, this symmetry, which is a very important tool in all problems that involve some gauge symmetry group. Okay. So, but I won't discuss this. This is a very important aspect if you want to understand really how things work and how you can define. You have to learn this stuff. Okay, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to discuss, of course, the most important point that came out from this calculation in the 60s, which is the calculation of the beta function and the discovery of what is called asymptotic freedom. In gauge theories. Okay, and again, this will be a very qualitative discussion, but okay. So out of this, I work out the fact that the coupling constant may be defined in such a way with B. I wrote what is B, I wrote what is A, they are related to those two coefficients. So in fact, for instance, computing just the two-point function for the gauge field and the three-point function for the gauge field gives you access to the renormalization of the field, A, and to the renormalization of the coupling constant. So from that, you get, as in 5.4, that there is a relation between the bare coupling constant and the renormalized coupling constant, which is, if I write it correctly, this is gr squared, 3 half of A1 minus B1. Log of lambda over mu. Just to remind you that this comes from computing some divergence in the two-point function and some divergence in the three-point function. So these are numbers. And out of that, of course, so this means that the renormalized coupling constant depends on the renormalization scale. And you define as in phi to the 4 the beta function for the renormalized complete constant as being the logarithmic derivative with respect to the renormalization scale of this renormalized complete when the physics, namely G bar, is fixed. And I'm computing this in the continuum limit. So first, I do the calculation for a fixed lambda, or a d less than 4, let us say. And once I have done this calculation, I take lambda goes to infinity to get the continuum limit. Exactly like as in phi to the 4 theory. It's exactly the same. Okay? And the important point, of course, the great discovery by Toft around 72, which was rediscovered and reproduced in 74 by Gross, Wilczek, and Sam, and I forgot the bad memory. Politzer. Politzer, of course. Around 74, I think, for SU3 and QCD, was that when you compute, okay, with such a definition of G, this is a G cube, I'm sorry. There is a G cube here. This is a G cube here, and this is a G to the 4, because one loop comes out with a G square term. Okay, is that this beta function has a minus sign. And if you compute it correctly, it is G to the cube. There is this usual 1 over 4 pi squared term that comes out from the integration of the. And you get, in fact, two terms. You get a minus 1 over 3 times some coefficient C2, nothing to do with the C, where this is some Casimir associated to some Casimir operator for the group G. So this depends on the gauge group. And if you add fermions, that's NF times some other quantity that depends on the representation for the fermions. So this C2 of G is, in fact, is just defined simply by the fact that if you consider FABCD, so I am summing over BC, I get something which is, CD, I'm sorry. BCD, this has to be proportional to delta AB, I guess, with some coefficient C2, this is the coefficient of the group, G. Okay, so it depends on the structure constant of the group. And this is some Casimir operator associated for the representation RF for the fermion fields. And this is a number of families of fermions. If you have one Dirac field, it's one. If you have two Dirac fields, it's two. Okay? Okay, and to end up for SUN, I think, if you look in the book, this coefficient C2 of G is N, so it's 2 for SU2. And for the fundamental representation, if RF is just the fundamental representation, then C of R fundamental, let us say, of fundamental is 1/2. Okay, that's basically that group theory. Okay, so of course the important point is that, the important point is that, so there is a G cube, but don't be worried about the G cube. There is a G cube because the coefficient, So this is a beta function for the coupling G. This is a G renormalized cube. But that's because, in fact, the real coupling constant, the alpha, the coupling constant, if you want, is alpha equal G squared, exactly like the coupling constant of quantum electrodynamics is E squared. And if you write the corresponding beta function for the real coupling constant alpha, it will be minus something alpha squared. Okay, so the beta function in terms of the physical coupling constant alpha is negative. And that's very important, because it means, remember, that the beta functions tell you how, as a function of the energy scale, does the effective coupling constant vary. So it tells you that if I define alpha of E as the effective or running coupling constant at energy E, E d d E of alpha of E behave like beta alpha of alpha of E. Well, this is beta function, the beta function for alpha. And the fact that it's negative means that when the energy increases, the effective coupling constant goes to zero. It means that when E goes to infinity, alpha of E goes to zero and basically has a 1 over log of E. So it goes slowly to zero, but it goes to zero. Okay? And that's very different from phi 4. So non-abelian gauge series, at least, or non-abelian gauge series with a small enough number of fermions, are very different from phi to the 4 or QED. Because they are what is called asymptotically free. At high energy or at short distance, the effective coupling, the effective charge of the particles becomes small, which means that it's a weakly coupled at high energy, while phi 4 QED is asymptotically free at high energy, or it's called asymptotic slavery. I presume it's not politically correct anymore, but this denomination was given in the 70s at high energies. It's strongly coupled. Okay, and this asymptotic freedom, so it's asymptotic freedom, is a very important property. Well, first, this was the first example of a discovery in an asymptotically free quantum field theory. Before that, most of the people, including some great name of theoretical physics, didn't believe that asymptotically free theory existed. And so this came as a surprise. And that's very important for at least two reasons. For experimental reasons. It means that particles that are bound by interacts through gauge bosons are almost free at short distance, at high energy, and this, for example, this explained the experiments that were taking place at SLAC at that point, where the model of quarks had been developed by Gell-Mann and Zweig, and showing that it's inside of hadron, in fact, like a proton, you were expected to have quarks, which had some quantum number associated to fermions. But they were bound in the hadron, so it means that there had to be some strong interaction between them, forbidding them to get out of the hadron. But high energy scattering of electron experiments showing that inside the hadron, some scattering was taking place as roughly speaking, as Thomson scattering of electrons on the nuclei of the atom, and showed that they were behaving like free particles inside the hadron. And this could be explained by the fact that the interaction bounding the quarks was described by exchange of gauge bosons associated to SU3 symmetry, QCD. But that if you were probing these particles at sufficiently high energy, the coupling between them and the coupling between them and the electrons that coming on was small, and therefore, well, not the coupling. The coupling was given by electromagnetic energy. But still, this explains why that, of course. So that's all the experiments that led to all the hadronic physics and high energy physics of the last, basically, 40 years. So no need to explain to the importance of this result. It's also important theoretically, because it shows that finally some quantum field theory makes sense beyond perturbation theory. Because remember, there is something that is a bit, you may be puzzled, and people have been puzzled about the strategy of renormalization theory in perturbation theory. The strategy is to assume that the coupling constant is small, introduce a cutoff, one of the strategies, discover that you have high energy divergence, absorb those divergence in renormalized coupling constant, and go on. But if you absorb the divergence, for instance, the bare coupling constant that I've written here, the bare coupling constant that is written here is very large. And you do the calculation as if it was very small. So there is an interchange of limit. G goes to zero, coupling constant small, and cutoff goes to infinity. That is quite shaky. And in fact, this can make sense in asymptotically free theory. Because in asymptotically free theory, this seems like a singular inference, but in fact, this is simply the first term of an expansion where the relation between the renormalized coupling constants and the bare coupling constant is of the form 1 plus gr log of lambda of mu. Okay, and with some coefficient here that is positive. Well, this coefficient will turn out to be positive if the beta function is negative, which means that, in fact, if you resum in a proper way perturbation theory, the bare coupling constants become small when lambda goes to infinity, precisely for this phenomenon. I'm considering a bare or an alpha, if you want. It works for, well, that's rather for alpha. Let me have alpha renormalized, where alpha equals d squared. Okay, this means that if I'm considering an alpha renormalized that is over the one, the bare coupling constant is in fact small. So perturbation theory makes sense to make this calculation. You just have to resum in a proper way, resum the ultraviolet divergences according to some renormalization group equation. And that's what the Wilsonian renormalization group flows. And then renormalization makes sense. Okay? And, well, even now, even some rigorous mathematical physicists have been able to make sense of this picture. So really put this in a rigorous framework with bound and epsilons and a lot of functional analysis. That's it took them decades to do that. But this makes sense. So for instance, now there is a proof, for instance, well, by two different groups, that non-abelian gauge theory makes sense in the continuum limit. Unfortunately, I'm going to end up there, and perhaps I will discuss that more later tomorrow. The price to pay when you have asymptotic freedom at high energy is that you have asymptotic slavery at low energy. So the theory is strongly coupled at low energy. And this leads precisely to the fact that the quarks inside an hadron that are a complicated bound state of quarks and gauge fields, the gluon in that case, that are charged. So in fact, it's an hadron is a very complicated bound state of particles, of fields in fact. So the number of particles, the number of gluons is fluctuating a lot. And you have virtual quarks. And you simply, for instance, for in a proton, you have three quarks at least that are always there because they have to be there in order for the proton to have its proper quantum numbers. But otherwise, it's a sea, if you want, or a liquid of what's called the three constituent quarks, virtual quarks, and gluons that are very strongly coupled, and that makes a very complicated system. And it's only when you look at very, very small scales that it looks like a free gas of gluons and quarks interacting very weakly. But when you go to the very scale of the proton, then the coupling becomes very, very strong and appears a phenomenon of confinement, which means that, in fact, you cannot extract any free quarks. And the fact that computing the properties of a hadron out of the original Lagrangian of QCD, which is a quite simple Lagrangian. You write it on a blackboard, and you can write it on a T-shirt. You can even add the electroweak sector and write it on a T-shirt. And nevertheless, the physics, of course, many problems, many progress have been made and some approximation scheme, but this is very, very, very difficult physics. Okay, so let me end here. And tomorrow we are going to discuss probably a bit more the non-perturbative aspects of gauge theories and, well, possibly other things. It depends. What? Okay, thank you.